All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome. Let's go ahead and get started, please, since it is just right at 30 seconds late. Not bad. So anyway, today I want to pick up. I have not gotten all your tests done, and I'm sorry about that. Probably at this point it'll be Friday before I get them back, and I still have two of you in here who need to take it, and I've got one person in the other class as well. So we'll get those straightened out. That's not a problem, but I would like to get those done before I get all the tests handed back. So if you remember, and I realize that you probably flooded your brain with all kinds of things getting ready for my exam, and I'm sure you had other exams and papers last week as well. When we talked last on Wednesday, not at the in the evening session, but during class, we were just really starting with the Roman Republic, and I'd given you two ideas about what could make the Republic work, and I also listed those three virtues. So we're going to pick up right there, and everything that we talked about on Wednesday will be a part of this second part of the course. So we're now in part two of the course. So part one, of course, dealt with everything up until Rome, and now we'll deal basically, I don't know how far we'll get, but we'll probably get from Rome till the High Middle Ages, and then the last part of the course will be the High Middle Ages up to the Reformation and right after that. Good morning, Shannon. So we're in part number two, and yet part number two, as we begin, is very similar to what we saw in the first part, because we're still in the ancient world, and we really won't be out of the ancient world until we get to St. Augustine. Once we get to Augustine and St. Jerome and St. Ambrose, once we get to them right about 400 AD, then we're out of the ancient world. But the ancient world doesn't end with Christianity. It continues for about another 400 years. So, and then we have this period, you don't need to write this down, but we have this period that we call Late Antiquity, which is really, it used to be called the Dark Ages, now we call it Late Antiquity. And you'll see why, there really was no such thing as the Dark Ages at all, ever. So we'll talk a little bit about that, but we'll get into it later. So right now we're going to finish up with Rome, and Rome has to be divided into two parts. So the first part is the Republic. And that's the good part. So we may disagree with some of the things. They were pretty hardcore, and I'm sure some of you had a chance to read Cato the Elder. And this guy's brutal. And yet he's very, very Roman in everything that he's arguing. In every way he acts, he's kind of the epitome of Roman patriarchy. And that patriarchy is huge. So the patriarchy itself, meaning, of course, rule by the father, is not just ruled by the father, it's ruled by the oldest man in a family. So that could be great-grandpa, or it could be grandpa, or it could be Uncle Billy, whoever it might be, but always the patriarch is the important one, and we can't even fathom what that world was like. The patriarchs had absolute control over their houses. So whatever they said within their own houses went. And it meant that if the patriarch, just like Cato, is not in trouble for killing 600 of his men on the march, if the patriarch thinks that you are misbehaving, it didn't usually apply to women, mostly to men, but if the patriarch thought that his great-grandson was a wastoid in some way, he'd have him executed, and that was perfectly legal. There was nothing wrong, I'm not saying morally nothing wrong, but legally that was absolutely accepted. In fact, it was encouraged that the patriarchy maintain its power in this way. And you probably saw when you read Cato, his wife is obviously upper class, and she enjoys all kinds of things in society, but she is still very much under the patriarch. And because it's patriarchy, we often think of it as being kind of very sexist, and it was, but it's really just power in that man. So the man had as much power over his sons as he did over his daughters. Generally, they didn't treat the daughters in the same way because there was a little bit more respect to them, which is kind of odd to think about. Maybe it's a strange respect that a feminism wouldn't like, but it's still there. So just keep that in mind, that these patriarchs are very, very powerful, and that society is really based on traditional morality in the way that we think of it, but always protected by the power of that patriarch. And the same thing with politics. So remember, again, if you had a chance to read Cato, when Cato runs for office, he tells people exactly what he's going to do to them. He says to them, you know, all these other guys promised you stuff. I'm not only not going to promise you stuff, I'm going to take your stuff away so you become a better person. And that was Cato. Yeah, Cato just laid it on the line. And of course, we're starting to see breaks because you've got other people saying, oh no, we'll redistribute the political stuff so you benefit. Cato says, absolutely not. Right? Nobody will benefit under my rule except everybody. So nobody in particular. So I am strictly for the common good, for the res publica. And astoundingly, he's elected. So, you know, this is a, you can't imagine now, can you imagine, you just can't, anybody telling you that they're going to take your stuff away and get elected. They'd be mobbed. They'd be like, yeah, imagine you'd be in a restaurant and they'd come throw you out. We can't even imagine that happening, right? That would never happen in our modern day and age, which is so civilized. Okay, so the history of the Republican, and this is the downside. The entire history of the Roman Republic, and it lasts about 400 years, the entire history is the history of decline. That's very hard to take, especially in the modern world, because we want successes. But there's no doubt from day one, the Republic is already starting to fall apart. So you've got this ideal, but you don't have anything except for these cultural norms to really hold it together. And that means if people start challenging the cultural norms, you can only counter those with other stronger cultural norms. And so these are the first culture wars we'll start seeing debated. And Rome, it's amazing they last 400 years, and it's chaotic. So, Carly, I'll get you in one second. One thing that I want you to know about the Roman Republic, and it's very different than the American Republic for the most part, the Roman Republic is from day one an experiment. So they don't know what they're doing, and they recognize that. They have no idea what they're doing. They are trying to figure these things out. So they create a Senate right away. It's the first body they create for political governance. And Senate means old wise men. So these are the patriarchs who represent their families, whatever they may be. We'd probably call them aristocrats now. They weren't quite aristocrats then, but close. And they take control. But a lot of people are dissatisfied with that. It's not enough that we have a rule based on just the patriarchy. And so we don't know exactly when, but probably within about 120 to 130 years of the Roman Republic, the people themselves, not being a part of the patriarchy, begin to heckle the senators. So literally, they would stand outside the Senate building, and when the senators would come out, they would mob them, just like what we've seen in the last week or two in restaurants. It's very similar. And to respond to this, what the Romans did, what the Senate did, is they said, fine, create your own assembly. And so they did. They created what we call a house, but they called the people. And the people began to meet. And that's how the Roman Republic developed. It was never sitting down like we did in Philadelphia and saying, here's branch 1, 2, and 3, article 1, 2, and 3. It was an experiment. And so there was always this trial and error. And so you'll get to times you can never really quite identify the Roman Republic specifically by its institutions. But generally, you'll see that there is a house, there is a Senate, there is a judicial branch, and there's an executive branch. But the executive gets really wacky because you'll have consuls and you'll have tribunes, and never just like us where we have a president and then all kinds of people under him. You'll have multiple executives, each claiming authority over the executive branch. And one of the great flaws of the Roman Republic, though again, they last 400 years. They've done better than we have so far. That may change, but up to this point, they did pretty well. So what they do in order to make sure that they have power is they create armies under each of these executives. And then the Senate will have its own army and the House will. You know, imagine if each of our Supreme Court justices had their own army. I mean, that's in many ways what was going on in Rome. And once you create an army, the only way you can feed them is by conquest. So you can't really go against your own people because they're your own people. You have to go into foreign conquest. So this is how the Republic starts decaying, because there becomes almost an expectation that armies will go out, get loot, and bring it back. So they're not only creating disharmony in the world, but they're also creating avarice at home, because people become more and more invested in the stuff that the armies are bringing back and redistributing to the people. So it's not a good situation, but again, it's also pretty successful. Within limits, they do a pretty good job. So, Carly.
Yeah, so I have two questions. It's just like kind of logistics, like for my notes. What was the time period that passed until the senators created the House?
We don't know. Nobody does. Just me. I mean, I'll admit when I don't know something, but nobody does. That whole era, really the first 200 to 300 years of the Republic, we only have rumors about. That's like when we talk about Cincinnatus, we have no idea if that guy really lived. It could be only just a rumor that was passed down.
Yeah.
So we do know for certain the Senate is founded in 509 BC. Okay. That's all we know. And we do know by about the year 200 that there is definitely a house, a people. They call it the people. There's a people in place, the Assembly, Congress, or at least the House of Representatives. And there are multiple judges and multiple executives. Okay. But so there are three branches, but they're chaotic.
Yeah.
In all kinds of ways. We do have one other date that's interesting. And I do want you to know this, just so you kind of see how much... Now remember, 510 and 509, those are important dates. So Rome is creating the Republic at exactly the same time Heraclitus is coming up with the Logos. So this is long before Plato writes his Republic. So the Republic is in existence before Plato imagines it. So obviously he's drawing upon things. And we have to ask, well, what's the connection then between the two? And here it is that I think is important. So the Greeks had attempted to colonize the boot of Italy, and they had done so pretty successfully. Corinth, in particular, had taken over Sicily and Sardinia, all that southern Italian area. So you've got Greek influence in the boot, right? When I say the boot, because you know I'm talking about Italy, more than just Rome, but Italy itself. So there is a lot of influence there. The Romans, in the date we have is 453. Whether that's accurate or not is probably up to debate, but it's the only date we have. The Romans, there are 10 men called the Decembers, which is where we get the term December. And these 10 men decide that they need to study, if the Republic's going to work, they have to study democracy because it's the one element they don't quite get within the three branches. So they send three representatives to Athens to study it. And so these guys show up, and you know, imagine the time period, 453, that's in between the Peloponnesian Wars, right, at one end, and the Persian Wars on the other. Turn that around, right, Persian Wars, then Peloponnesian Wars. They come, and they just think the Greeks are a bunch of decadent people, and so they go back to Rome and say, there's nothing we can learn from these people. That's really telling, because we think so highly of Greek democracy, and yet there it is. These three Republicans for Rome think this place is just a cesspool of decadence.
Yeah.
But that's because of the, in, as they see it, the sexual and marital infidelity.
Yeah.
Right? That's how they see it. Go ahead, Carly.
And then my second question was, you said there were two parts of the Roman Republic. Was the first one patriarchy?
Of Rome.
Of Rome.
So the first half's the Republic. The second half is the Empire.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the Empire were...
Empire starts in 43 days. B.C. We'll get to that in just a bit.
Yeah.
Empire officially starts 43 BC. 43. Yeah, so 43 years before Christ started, roughly.
Sorry, what was the importance of the 510 and 509 again? That's the Logos in the Republic.
Yep, 510 is when Rome rebels against the Etruscans. 509 is when they create the Republic.
Okay.
So same time that in Greece you have the pre-Socratics arguing. Okay, cool. All right, Lionel.
Sir, how did they survive or get... it seems like the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic,
yeah,
and then it transitioned to the Empire around.
Yes.
After Alexander. So
yes, after.
Get out of that unscathed, so to speak.
Alexander, remember, he went east, so he didn't go to Rome.
Okay.
He went all the way to India, turned around at the Ganges River, and then came back to Egypt. So that was it. So he never got into Rome or into Carthage. Those were the two major powers in the Western Mediterranean. So now he could have, had he survived, he might have. That would have been interesting. I think the Romans would have defeated him, but I don't know. That would be a fascinating. That'd be an incredible paper to kind of figure out what Alexander would have done. But I would put my odds on the Romans. You guys, I don't know if you know. I mean, the Romans, and we can talk about this. They're when they become the Empire, they are as nasty. I mean, they're one of the worst powers in the world. But as the Republic, they're incredible. And they had, I don't want to get off on this too much today, but they were so technologically advanced in terms of engineering and in terms of pavement technology, stuff we take for granted, but also medicine. They even had automatic spear throwers. So they had a Gatling gun that shot spears. Nobody, the Greeks invented napalm, so they had what was called Greek fire. That was pretty amazing. But the Romans had automatic weapons. Now, they're not, you know, greased and mechanical like our, like you would have done in the Marines. You sit there with big cranks. They're more like Civil War era. But they're still incredible. You know, and to think that even to this day, any of you who travel to Rome, you know, if you cross through Austria, you're still crossing on a bridge that was built in the Roman Republic. That's how long these things lasted. Every Roman, almost every European highway today is still on the foundation of Roman Republican roads. That's incredible. We didn't even have that kind of pavement technology again. We had lost it until about the 1880s. And then we get concrete again. I mean, it is so hard. We take it, now you can go to Home Depot and buy bags of the stuff. But it took us 2,000 years to recreate this stuff. And we still, there's still, even in architecture, there are arches the Romans had in their buildings that we, even with computer modeling, we don't know how they did it. They stand, and we can measure them. We have no idea how they built them. None. These guys are incredible. And our medicine didn't catch up to the Roman Republic until about 1890. So Western medicine. So that, if you want to talk about a dark age, technologically, yes, we'll lose a lot. But these guys were stunning. And there's no, I guess I really didn't mean to get off on this now, but there is absolutely no country in Europe, none, except for one, who doesn't see themselves as modern Rome. Every country believes that they are the incarnation of the Roman Republic in some way. Anybody know the one exception? And this is really trivial, but it's kind of fun. Switzerland. They call themselves the Confederation Helvetica, the Confederation of the New Greeks. But everybody else is Roman. Everybody else. I mean, there's even a Romania. Right? It's like, and, of course, Russia considers itself Rome. Yeah, they've always considered themselves Rome. They're the third Rome. So Rome is everything. And our founders...
So who was the second Rome?
Second Rome was Byzantium. So Constantinople. Right? So the Eastern Orthodox Church. Yeah, we'll get to that. But, yeah, so those are the three Romes. And our American founders were Romans. They could care less about the Greeks. They're Romans in every way. That's how they see themselves. The way they dress when they wear togas at college parties, that's not myth. They would, at a college party, you would be expected to give an oration in Latin. That's what college parties were like. So, and you couldn't speak anything but Latin. If you went to, say, William and Mary, everywhere in your dorms, you were expected to speak Latin. That's what people did. Up until even where I went, Notre Dame, the men still had to speak Latin until the 1920s. So, yeah, that's incredible. So, you know, to think about that. Anyway, Carly, go ahead.
How does that happen, like, that we lose technology? Like, mm-hmm. Do people just how?
Yeah, it's a great question, but it can just, yeah, we lose it. We always do. This happens all the time. Imagine a new people come in, barbarians invade. You just lose it. There's suddenly, think about this. We had to, for the building, right, you guys are watching the church go up.
Yeah.
Nobody in America, not a single person in America, can do the fitting of the bricks right. So we had to hire an Italian who's here right now to do those. And that's a very rare skill. And only the Italians, and it's through a family, they've kept the secret of how to do this. Huh. I mean, that's just, you know, it's like cooking in the sense that, think about family recipes. A lot of these things, they keep to a guild. The guild falls apart. The Nazis come in. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? It's almost always the Germans that cause a lot of problems. But you know, they come in, they disrupt things, and you lose it.
Okay.
And you get these barbarians come in, and they take over this highly advanced civilization. They can play with the toys. They have no idea what to do with them once they're broken.
Yeah.
So that's what happens. Okay. It could happen to us. There's no reason America is immune from this. You know, imagine the Iranians launch an EMP above us. Who in here is going to survive, unless you're Mormon and have 2 years' worth of food stored? You're probably not going to make it more than a month. You know, that, I mean, we're doomed.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be pessimistic here. It's just, this is history.
Yeah,
or imagine a new disease. Half of England died in 2 years because of the Black Plague. You know, you never know. And this stuff can happen at any time. Think about if Ebola just went crazy and airborne. I mean, we're done. So, sorry. Did not mean to get off on this today. Bryson.
There's a modern-day example of that, of engines that we made for aircraft and spacecraft back in the 1970s.
Yes, absolutely.
That we actually cannot recreate
today. That's right.
This day.
That's right.
That's because at the time, there was like master engineers and master welders who were putting it together, but we don't have enough people with that knowledge and that skill today to be able to recreate that.
That's absolutely right. To go back to the moon, we would have to rebuild all of those technologies that we've lost just in my lifetime.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, Bryson's absolutely right. And that's the best modern example, certainly. Lionel. Okay, Leo, did you have your hand up? Somebody else.
No,
did.
I had mine.
Oh, I'm sorry, Soren.
You said Alexander the Great stopped at the Ganges, but I think you said the
Hindus. Yeah, I was wrong. It's the Ganges. It's the Ganges. I said the Hindus, okay. But it's actually the Ganges. Yeah, I won't count you off on that if you put that on the test, because that was my fault, but it is the Ganges.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Kenna.
This is just kind of a humorous thing. If you were worried about getting depressing in class with all of us potentially dying, I remember a pastor once who used to say anytime someone would be like, okay, what are you doing? Because I lived in Arizona and he used to hike a lot. So if he would go near to a cliff and somebody would be like, what are you doing, pastor? You're getting too close to the edge. He'd be like, heaven, baby. And that was his, that was his
very
perspective
nice.
On it.
So, you know, I can see that if I didn't have kids. But, you know, I'm not sure I want to just head off to heaven and leave them alone. But I understand. I do want to go to heaven. I'm just not sure I want to leave my kids behind. So, Shelby.
Okay, I have a question about Cicero.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're going to get back to him.
Okay. I mean,
oh, go ahead, Shelby.
Okay.
This is a class of detour.
I was just wondering, because he seems to put a lot of, like, trust in human character.
Yes.
And I know, like, the way our government is set up seems to have a little bit more of a pessimistic
yes.
view. That, like, everyone will work for self-interest, and so that's why we need, like, checks and balances. But he seems to say, like, oh, just everybody should be good.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a moment. So,
okay.
And at least I was hoping to today, it may be Wednesday now, but he has this view, and this is a great point, Shelby, and it's where he's clearly a pagan and not living in the Christian era yet. He is, we always regard the two great final pagans of the world who... these are, most people would assume if Christianity existed, they would have become Christian because of the way that they point to this, but obviously we'll never know because they lived before. But the last great pagans are Cicero and Cato the Younger. Not Cato the Elder, but his great-grandson, Cato the Younger. And that's why when you get into Dante in particular, now Dante is never necessarily theologically correct, he might be, but it's a poet, it's a poem. And that's why when you read it, it's Cato the Younger who's guarding purgatory. So he's the one who makes sure that those in hell can't creep out and get into purgatory. He's the guardian. But he's a pagan. And that's pretty fascinating. Even Cicero's in hell. He's the highest level of hell. He's in the waiting room in hell where he has to listen to Aristotle lecture for eternity. But, you know, that's not where some guy's eating your brains out, right, in the lower levels of hell. So it's still, there's not a punishment in a sense, except he'll never be with God. But Cato makes it, which is really interesting. And Cato actually committed suicide, which makes it even more interesting. So, but Cicero's a martyr. We'll see that in just a bit. But you're absolutely right, Shelby. That's his stoicism. And his stoicism says that any good person, through free will, can choose the good. Bless you, Carly. Bless you again. Almost.
Almost.
any person can choose the good, even in the greatest circumstances of adversity. Now, Cicero never had an image that all people could do it, but a significant minority of people could do it to keep society good. So it's not that different than Jefferson. Actually, it's very similar. But, of course, Jefferson's not a Christian either. So it makes sense that they have this kind of very airy vision of man. So, okay, who else had there? Someone over here. Shannon, did you have your hand up? No. Okay, Carly and Ken, and then I want to get back to Cicero.
I'm getting confused by all the Catos. There's a Cato the Elder and a Cato
right.
the Younger.
So Cato the Elder is the great-grandfather of Cato the Younger. Same
okay.
family. But
yeah.
The name Cato is passed down.
And Cato the Elder is like the prototype Puritan, but then what about Younger?
Younger is, he's George Washington, essentially. George
okay.
Washington, that his hero is the second in command of Cato. He signs his name, Juba. Juba was the African prince who fought next to Cato the Younger. So,
okay.
yeah, he had the play called Cato, a Tragedy, performed 7 times during the winter of Valley Forge. Washington had the whole play memorized. These are his heroes. So...
Okay.
He's essentially the last fighter against Caesar.
In which war?
in the civil war of that moves from the Republic to the Empire. Cicero and Cato are the last people holding out for the Republic. I'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
Yeah, we just haven't gotten to it. Kenna.
So did Jefferson regard himself as a
star? He's an Epicurean. Okay. He calls it, yeah. I don't want to get too much off on that yet. Okay, so let me go back to the Republic. And I want to just read to you briefly from one of the great historians of the time. And I'd mentioned this guy to you earlier, but his name's Livy, L-I-V-Y. And he will be very important as well, to get to Kenna's question, to all of the founders. But he's a big deal at the time as well. He's writing right after the Republic has fallen. And so he says, "Events before Rome was born or even thought of have come to us in old tales with more of the charm of poetry than of a sound of historical record." So much more like Herodotus than Thucydides. "And such traditions I propose neither to affirm nor refute. There is no reason I feel to object when antiquity draws no hard line between the human and the supernatural." So who am I to judge? Right? If we think that Rome was founded by the gods, it was founded by the gods. It's good enough for me. Right? Even if I don't actually believe in the gods, it's a story we can believe. The story has divine significance. It adds dignity to our past. And if any people deserves the privilege of claiming a divine ancestry, that must be Rome. Rome itself, which was established through Mars, through war, and through conquest. However, from the very beginning, we can see. Now, here's the absolute ultimate Republican pessimism here in every way. From the beginning, we can trace the process of moral decline. So from the first moment, from 509 until now, he's writing roughly about 10 BC. There's nothing but moral decline. Now, sometimes it's fast, sometimes it's slow, but the whole history of a republic is decay. And that's okay. He's still a Republican, still the best form of government. We just know that we'll decay. So we must watch first the sinking of the foundations of morality as the old teachings were allowed to lapse, and then the rapidly increasing disintegration, and then the final collapse of the entire edifice. You may ask, why do I write history? Because in history, you have a record of the infinite variety of human experience set out for all to see. So this is what we must understand. Why did Rome fall? Because wealth made us greedy. Self-indulgence brought us into every form of sexual excess. And to be, if I may put it, we became in love with death itself. Now just think about that. That's a powerful statement in every way. All right, we've lost our traditional teachings. We've lost the family. And now we actually fear death so much that it's all we think about. Rather than, as Kenna said, we just accept it in the Stoic fashion or the Christian fashion when God brings it to us. Okay, so we're always fighting it. And by fighting it, we become obsessed with it. And by becoming obsessed with it, we let us conquer us. So this is how he sees this. And that is a perfect understanding of the pessimism of a republic. Leo.
Oh, sorry, who was that?
No problem. Livy. L-I-V-Y. Right, and we'll come back to him a little bit. Okay, so now I want to get into, unless there are other questions on that. Go ahead.
Could you just quickly reread his sentence where he's saying, like, as the old teachings decay?
Yeah. So, as the old morality, right? So, we trace the process of moral decline, and we watch, first, the sinking of the foundations of morality as the old teaching was allowed to lapse, and then the rapidly increasing disintegration, and then the final collapse of the whole edifice. So, that's the fall, right? But it takes 500 years, ultimately. So, Shelby.
This is probably just me not knowing very much about Rome, but is the reference to, like, being in love with death itself, is that anything to do with the, gladiators?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. The bloodthirstiness of the arena, absolutely. Okay. Right, but it's also, we now start building tombs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rather than just being simple, we now have to celebrate our deaths and have, it's a different kind of thing. And you're not celebrating because of the next life. Right. You're celebrating because the family's lost it here. And it becomes an obsession mm-hmm. for Romans. And actually, I'm not a moral historian. I mean, I may be somewhat moral and a historian, but I'm not a historian of morality. But it does seem to be the case that we can almost always find the decline of cultures when people start worshiping death. Once they do that, it really does seem like they're close to the end. This is, if you've read Tolkien in the Second Age, the Numenoreans, this is why they go bad, because they worship death and they fear it rather than accepting it as a norm. Carly.
Do you think America does that?
Well, yes and no. This is a huge topic, but in the 19th century, I think we had a pretty healthy view of death as a part of life. And look at every makeup, all the liposuction, everything is about postponing. We're still pursuing the fountain of youth. We don't allow, think about how few people age gracefully. So many people get their eyes done, and it's disgusting. I'm sorry, I think it's just disgusting. But I don't get it. So, Kenna.
How then would you view Hispanic culture and Dia de los Muertos?
Well, that's different because there's still an almost healthy understanding that death is still a powerful force. So I actually think, for example, if we celebrate Halloween properly, there's nothing wrong with it because it is a recognition that death is a part of life. But that's different than we would never make Halloween a sacred night. It's not like Easter morning. There's something because we've got to focus on the resurrection. But the Mexicans have, I think, a very healthy respect in many ways.
Because
they're
not
decadent like we are. They may have their own problems, but they're not wealthy enough to be decadent, for one thing. It's very hard to be decadent if you don't have lots of money. So, but we'll get into that later. I want to read to you, this is Cicero that you don't have, but this is from his work. So let me explain quickly who Cicero is. I sent you all an email this morning that listed not only the dates of Cicero, but the 8 points that I think are most important to understand about Cicero. Cicero is born in 106 BC, and he is murdered in 43 BC. So those are his years, and he has a good run. Any of you who've taken Latin, you know that Cicero is still to this day, and of course, who's going to top him? He is the greatest of both Latin writers and speakers. So the Ciceronian style in writing, as well as in speaking, is the ultimate style you can have. So the medievals, because they lose a lot of their understanding of the dialect, will change it into a church Latin, understandably. And it's equally legitimate. It's just that the Ciceronian Latin is always the goal. Cicero is, for all intents and purposes, the great embodiment of the Republic itself. I mean, if we wanted to say, what does this person represent? He is the greatest of the Republic. So I want to read something here. This is from, he writes a whole number of books, and there are a lot of things he does that are important. He is the first to take Greek philosophy seriously. Most Romans had taken the arts of the Greeks, but they hadn't taken philosophy because they thought good men don't sit around and think, they work hard. And Cicero is really the first to bring Greek philosophy in and to make it palatable to the Romans. But of course, Rome is declining. So you don't have to write this down. I love this passage. Most of his books are letters to his oldest son. So you guys read De Officiis, right, On Duties. And On Duties is his letter to his son, explaining to his son what a man is. Right, what a human is, because he talks about women too, but what does it mean to be a human person? And De Officiis, On Duties. Notice, for Cicero, we are always defined by what we give, never by what we take. That's critical to understand. This is not a natural rights thinker, though he believes in natural rights. This is a natural law thinker. He wants to know what you're going to give to the Republic. That's what matters most. You're never defined by having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You're defined by how much you gave to your community, the common good. Now, you can't be forced to do that. Right? Once you're forced to do it, you've lost the goodness. It's not a virtue anymore. So you have to be ready to sacrifice. But here's what he writes in his book, The Republic, and it's an answer to Plato. So he's trying to answer Plato, same title, The Republic. And he says, he quotes from an old Stoic poem, that the Republic of Rome is founded firm on the ancient customs and the men of might. So everything Rome had always lasted because there were good customs and because men were willing to die for those customs. Right? Those are the two pillars of the Roman Republic. Good customs, men willing to die for those. This poet seems to obtain these words, so brief and yet so true, from the oracle. For neither men alone, unless a republic is supplied with customs too, nor customs alone, unless there have been men to defend them, could ever have been sufficient to found or preserve a republic so long, whose dominion extends so far and wide. So once again, there's no possibility to have a good republic without good laws and customs and men willing to die for them. Right? Those are the two pillars. So obviously there was success, no matter what failings. We can't expect perfection here. Yeah, Cicero is not going to do that except for a few who will choose wisely. But a state itself, right, a republic, it can't last. We know that. But, he says, thus before our time, the customs of our ancestors produced excellent men, and eminent men preserved our customs and our institutions because they loved their fathers. Now, I love that. If you love your fathers, you'll probably do okay in life. That's a fascinating statement. Right? You lose your respect for your mom and dad, everything's over. But though the Republic, when it came to us, right, so in his lifetime, was a beautiful painting whose colors time had not only neglected to refresh in it by renewing the original colors, but we had not even taken the trouble to preserve its frame. So we're given this gorgeous painting. The frame's decaying, and even the colors of the original painting are almost gone. We don't know what happened. They're just gone. We didn't take care of it, this beautiful thing. For what is now left of the Republic, on which the ancient customs of our Republic was founded firm, they have been, as we see, so completely buried in oblivion that they are not only no longer practiced, but if I asked anyone about them, they would not know them. And what shall I say of our present men? For our loss of customs is due to our lack of men. And the great evil we must not only give and account for, but we must defend ourselves in every possible way. For you must understand, we ourselves are now guilty of murder. Now think about that. We ourselves, we can't just blame our fathers. Yeah, they screwed up. But we've screwed up too. And now we're the ones holding this thing that's ready to collapse. And if it does, we've murdered it because we never upheld it. Right? We will be guilty of this. For though it is through our own faults and never by any accident that we retain only the name of a republic, but we have long since lost the understanding and essence of the republic. Right? That's Cicero. So we forgot it, and it's totally our fault. We cannot blame anyone because we could have picked up the pieces and fixed it. We didn't do it. We just let this thing slide. So here's what I want to tell you about him and why he's a martyr before we get into anything else, because no matter what he does, all of his orations, his leading of government, all of these things are vital to understanding him. His discussion of language, his rhetoric, all of this matters. But to me, and you'll notice a theme in this class, as we'll see here, all the best people are killed. Cicero was killed. And what happens in 44 and 43 BC, there is a takeover. And so you've got a coup. Julius Caesar, the first of the great emperors, and by great, I don't mean good, I just mean important. Julius Caesar takes over. And when he does, as the Republic is collapsing, as Julius Caesar does, of course, he takes the name Caesar. Caesar is a Republican term originally. It just means first citizen. So it's not a bad thing. George Washington was a first citizen. Obviously, though, it becomes bad. In fact, it's still the term czar. That's where the term czar in Russia comes from. It's a corruption of Caesar. So Caesar just meant first citizen, but then it'll become emperor. And so Julius takes over, and he decides, and Julius has his bad points, to be sure, but he decides that it's not worth taking down the whole Republic. And in fact, he really likes Cicero, even though they disagree. Everybody loves Cicero. And so he says, I'm not going to touch him. Cicero can keep arguing against me as long as he wants. Stand in the Senate. Well, as you know, I'm sure, from all kinds of things, Shakespeare and other things, he's murdered. And when he's murdered, Mark Antony takes over. So Mark Antony, you know, if Caesar's a bad man with some good qualities, Mark Antony is just a bad man with absolutely nothing good going for him at all. So Mark Antony takes over. He's not about to declare himself Caesar, but he's close. And of course, he doesn't do anything without the last of the Greek princesses from Alexander's time. And the one remaining person is Cleopatra. She's not an Egyptian. She is a Greek. She's the last of the Greeks. Once she's gone, the Greeks will never have control over Egypt again. But she's the last of that whole movement of Alexander the Great. So Mark Antony says, when he comes in, I hate, absolutely hate Cicero. He represents everything that is wrong with a good, solid rule. And Mark Antony truly does believe in everything that's bad. He truly does believe the Republic will only be solved through the very iron-fisted rule of one man. But he's also utterly corrupt. So it's not just that he thinks that he has to come in and establish order. He wants all the goodies that go with it, too. He wants all the benefits, all the money. He wants all of this. And so does Cleopatra. She's a total scoundrel. So they're going to do this. And what they do, which is just shocking, they have, within a few days, two-thirds of the Roman Senate and about half of the assembly murdered. So when Cicero is executed, he's one of about 600. There are about 900 members of the Roman Senate. And he has 600 of them wiped out. But Cicero is by far the most important of those who are killed. So here's what Cicero does. He knows, much like Socrates, he could have fled easily. In fact, he had the money, he had the means, he had the friends. He could have gotten out of there very easily. But instead, he waits in his villa. And he waits for Mark Antony's men to come. Because he knows it's over, and the only way he can defend the Republic is by being the final symbol of the Republic. For somebody to remember, even if it's 1,000 years, somebody will remember his death, his sacrifice. He's not arrogant about this. In fact, Cicero's just not arrogant. This is just necessary. He has to die a good death. And so Mark Antony does send his men. And here, I'm just going to tell you the story as it's related in Plutarch. You guys can judge it in any way you want. I'm just going to tell you what Plutarch says, our best evidence for it, but it's very supernatural. So they go down to Cicero's villa. These two men, imagine these big thugs, you know, basically big Italian mafia, right? They come in and they grab him. They throw him down on the floor and they saw off his hands because those were the hands that wrote against tyranny. And once they've sawed off his hands, they cut his head off. So that, of course, it's very important symbolically. They're separating his rationality from his reason. That's absolutely, this is all symbolic. But it's true, too.
Rationality from reason.
Rationality of the mind, reason of the soul. Right? So they're cutting off the head from the soul. And Mark Antony has given orders to his men to leave the body there to decay, but to bring the hands and the head back to Rome. So they do. They carry the head and the hands back. And Antony, in his absolute disgusting, diabolical way, takes the head of Cicero and he nails it onto the Senate roster. So right there in front of the entire Senate, at the podium, he just nails the head in and leaves it there with the hands sticking out as well. He's got them both nailed, all three things, right? Two hands, one head, nailed there. And he decides to give a speech about the death, and I realize this is all going to sound like George Lucas in Star Wars, but you'll know where he got it. He gives this speech, Mark Antony does, in which he proclaims the rise of a new republic out of the death of the old republic. The old republic is done. It was corrupt. It decayed. Now we'll have the new republic led by a strong man. And so here's what Plutarch and a few other sources from the day say. They claim. So imagine the Senate. There are 900 people in there. Mark Antony's just killed 600, and he's replaced all 600 with his friends. And then the other third were so wishy-washy and wimpy, right? They're like, that guy Flake. They're all right there. And they had no guts at all. So he doesn't care about them. He didn't need to kill them. They're that wishy-washy. So one third of these guys are worthless tapioca, and the other guys are his friends. So he's basically packed all of these people who are all his friends, essentially, or neutral. And he gives this speech. Every one of those senators who was there, and this is the mystical part that you just have to judge on your own, but every one of those senators said, as Mark Antony gave that speech, Cicero's soul arose and blocked Mark Antony from sight, that they could not see Mark Antony giving that speech. Instead, they could only see Mark Antony's soul writhing in hell during the whole speech. Now, you take that any way you want it, but it's astounding to think about what, even if it's purely symbolic, what it means. Right? This is the death. So one of my favorite scholars, and you don't need to write his name down, but one of my favorite scholars, Russell Kirk, in his History of Western Civilization, writes, with the death of Cicero, so fell the Republic. Right? It's that. That's it. Once Cicero's gone, the Republic's over. There's nothing left of it anymore. So that's how powerful of a figure he was. But I don't, for the purposes of this class, notice what we've seen so far. The greatest of the Greeks, Socrates, dies in martyrdom. The greatest of the Roman Republicans dies in martyrdom. This is going to be a theme that we'll see over and over and over again. But we also, I hope you notice something else. And this is, so number one, martyrdom is really critical to the advancement of proper morals. Now, I'm not advocating we go out and martyr people. I'm just saying historically, we see that's the case. Sacrifice for the right cause means everything. But there's another rule that we can start seeing in history. Notice when Cicero arose. Notice when Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle arose. Where are they at in terms of their civilizations? Lionel, absolutely. All of the greatest thinkers in world history have always come at the end of their civilizations. Hmm. Always. Anyone want to, St. Augustine's the same way, Dante as well. Anyone want to take a guess why? There's actually a logic to it, but history's fickle, right? So many things could happen. Rose?
Is it because they see all that's wrong around them?
Absolutely. They're not in the middle of it. So by being at the end, they can be somewhat objective, but there's also this incredible nostalgia. So when Plato writes of the Republic, it's so long gone. This is a dream at this point. This is, you know, think about what we do with the founding. And I think it's a proper thing to do, but we mythologize and moralize it, especially at Hillsdale, right? It's one of the things we do very well. But we make it this moment, this centerpiece. And, of course, when you look, for example, at what was really going on in Philadelphia as they're debating the Constitution, they're pretty much like anybody else. They're fighting. You know, they're having all kinds of disagreements. It's not pretty, not like the Federalist Papers make it. There's rough and tumble politics going on, but we mythologize it. That's exactly what Plato's doing. Plato is saying, look at Heraclitus. Everything was great then. Everything was perfect. And, of course, it wasn't. But it's a lot better than when he's writing. And here's Cicero. Look what it was like when Cato the Elder was around. Look what it was like when Cincinnatus was the great man. I can show you in our history these people who seem almost perfect. Right, so those are the people. And so we always do this. But yeah, Lionel's absolutely right about this. It's always at the end of a period that we start finding what was best before it. And that there's a strange irony in that. But imagine if you're in the middle of goodness, it's really hard to define because you take it for granted. It's what life is. Life is this. Why would you think it's bad? It's maybe someone else has it bad. We don't. So it's whenever you start seeing a culture criticizing itself, that's a bad sign as well. I mean, it's healthy. We have to criticize ourselves, but to the point where we see no hope, well, then there's probably no hope. I mean, that's, hope is a funny thing. If you believe it exists, it exists. If you don't, it doesn't. It's that simple. So it's a faith more than anything else. Lionel.
Well, it seems like a natural progression because you'll have a good generation, a great generation, yep, followed by a bad generation. It seems,
yes,
like no generation truly recovers to greatness.
And yet,
and then after a series of bad generations, you said people who look back and go, well, what made the great generation great?
Yeah, and of course, you're absolutely right. But think about how implanted it is in our own psyches, all of us sitting in this room, that we're in cycles, right? That's the hard question, because we all think in cycles, all of us. And it's just so much a part of Western history that we do that. So we also then pattern our own thoughts about history based on those cycles, which probably are true, but it's hard for us as Westerners to judge it too, because it's a Western thought. So it is difficult, if that makes sense. I mean, there's a paradox there in trying to understand what history is. So this is a great point. Okay, so final thing, and I'm going to read to you just, and this is on the sheet I gave you that I sent to you this morning, but I just want to read one last thing. We've got about 2 minutes left. And I promise Shelby, when we come back, we're going to talk about perfection and if it's possible. So here's what, this is the first great actual complicated statement ever made about natural law. So remember, Epictetus has already said something in the Stoic realm, but it's a faith. Now we'll start seeing it more as reason. And this is, so here is, this is from On the Republic. Again, I quoted from On the Republic a little bit ago. This is from On the Republic, where Cicero gives us, and you guys have to memorize this, but we can talk about it more on Wednesday, just the first line. Cicero says, true law is right reason in agreement with nature. So you don't have to write it down right now. We'll talk about it first thing on Wednesday. But I do want you to memorize that, and I want you just to think what that means.
Can you say it again?
True law, right, the head, where our intellect is right reason, the soul, in agreement with nature, our passions. That's what natural law is. Natural law is not some mysterious thing. It's an understanding of the human person and a recognition that we are patterned after the divine. And by the way, Cicero, amazingly enough, is a monotheist. So we'll talk about that as well in a little bit. But true law is right reason in agreement with nature. Okay, thanks everybody. Great class. I'll see you on Wednesday. And just make sure you've read all the Cicero and finished up the Roman Republic. As soon as we're done with Cicero, we're going to go to Christianity. So we're not going into the empire. We're going to go to Christianity next. So if you want to start reading the first four readings of Christianity, have at it. You will definitely have to have read them by Friday.
Is that a quote by Cicero that you just read to us?
Yeah, true. I've got it on the sheet I sent you this morning. Oh. True law is right reason in agreement with nature. Yeah. So, but if you remember it this way, right, the three parts of the body,
yeah,
you'll know it.
I'll try to decapitate it. Yeah,
yeah. That's right, exactly.